history through the eyes of those who lived it. This is Hometown Heroes, proudly honoring the men and women whose service and sacrifice have secured our freedom. Now, the host of Hometown Heroes, Paul Leffler.
Welcome to another edition of Hometown Heroes, the program that reminds you no matter where you live in this great country of ours, no matter how big or how small your hometown might be, there are stories there waiting to be told. We want to honor our veterans for their service and sacrifice, preserve their stories so we never forget the price that's been paid for our freedom. And when we do that, we end up learning a lot. We're educated, we're entertained, and so often we really are inspired by these stories from our greatest generation. Last weekend, we had Pearl Harbor Day, so the program focused on four amazing Pearl Harbor survivors. This week marks a significant anniversary as well. On Sunday, December 15th, they're gathering in Washington, D.C. for a candlelight vigil and the reading of more than 6,000 names, all Americans confirmed killed in action during the Battle of the Bulge. The next day, December 16th, marks the 75th anniversary of the start of that massive engagement. And that's when the official commemoration will take place at the National World War II Memorial. Over the years, we've heard from dozens of veterans who were involved in one way or another with the Battle of the Bulge. We've heard about intense combat, the unforgiving weather that left so many with frozen feet and fingers. We've heard from those wounded, those captured, and even from some who escaped their captors. And we're going to get a taste of all of those plot lines today. It's been estimated that nearly 20,000 Americans gave their lives in that six-week battle. Nearly 50,000 were wounded and nearly 25,000 captured. A good chunk of those who became prisoners did so at the very outset of the battle, when communications miscues caused more than 6,000 men of the 106th Infantry Division to, in effect, be hung out to dry. Men like Mac McMullen and the rest of his anti-tank platoon had been told they were headed to a quiet sector in the Ardennes Forest.
They put us up there to get some experience. As an example, for the gun they give us, we had five rounds of ammunition for that 57-millimeter gun. Our own personal, we had two clips on our belt for our rifle and one in the rifle. And that's all the ammunition we had. We couldn't beat a Boy Scout troop, you know. but it was supposed to be a quiet zone to let us get adapted to what we were doing and get a little bit of experience before we see the big fight.
So what was the first inkling you had that this was not a quiet zone and that you had company in this neighborhood?
Well, I'll tell you a little story along that line. The sergeant and I were up on out of the bunk. It was just getting dark.
Mm-hmm.
And with those trees, that with the forest, they were close together, straight pine trees and snow on the ground. And if somebody was walking, you could follow them because the snow would blank out where mm-hmm. they were walking. And we were up there, and all at once we looked out and we see some, maybe 50 yards away, something like that. And I don't know who fired first, whether my sergeant fired or they fired or what, but there was a little short exchange and then it all quit. So Art couldn't have fired the first round because he didn't fire any, I did. And I said, well, why didn't you fire? And he was a married man with a couple of kids. And he says, I thought a guy might have a kids at home like I have.
Hmm.
The irony of this is that out of our group, the first guy to get killed was Art later on in a time. But he wouldn't shoot, and then he ends up being the one that gets killed.
He didn't want to deprive some kids of their father.
Yeah.
And his children were deprived of their father.
So the next morning, on the 16th, daybreak, all hell broke loose. That's when the shells start flying. Mm-hmm. And they just come and come and come. And they did for, 2 days while we stayed there 2 nights. We were there the 16th and 17th, and then the 18th. And then we got orders to move out on the 19th. And we got the truck and the cannon and started and fell in line. There was trucks as far as you could see in a line.
I can only imagine.
It was, by now it's slow. You stop and you sit there and this. Eventually we ended up on this long, narrow hillside road. if you fill that all full of trucks, it was like going to the carnival. These guys were down here with 88s that could hit that thing those up there without any trouble, and we couldn't move. By now, we were boxed in.
So you were sitting ducks with the German artillery aimed right at you.
Yeah. So that's when we got orders to surrender. We were captured late in the evening and marched down the hill. I didn't have combat boots because they didn't have my size. So I got the regular shoe, and I tried to go through a little stream where you jump across. I got both feet wet, got them frozen. Mm-hmm. And later on, as things went on, because we walked that particular time, we walked from the middle of that afternoon, all that night, all the next day, and then before we stopped. And by the time we got there, my feet were frozen, and I was at the point where I couldn't make it anymore. And this is when I went to church and Sunday school and all that, but I was one of these guys that prayed for a bicycle or something like that. And I was holding back saving that, I guess. I didn't know it. But I prayed that just give me one more half mile. Just give me one more half mile. And then I got to where I was getting ready to drop out. And somebody I don't know, never saw him before. I've never seen him since. He was a big guy. He grabbed me by put me on his shoulder or arm, and he helped me. And with him and some other help, I got there through the night and the next day. But that was tough because I couldn't. I was ready to drop out. I just couldn't go anymore.
And for our listeners, tell us what that would have meant if you would have dropped out. You would have been left for dead, or maybe
they might shoot me, or mm-hmm. to make sure I wasn't playing games with them, and so that they didn't. No, they didn't. I'd have frozen. My feet were already frozen. I couldn't go anywhere.
You know? So you thought that was it?
Yep, that was as close as I've ever come.
And a desperate prayer was answered, and a big, strapping fellow American who.
Right.
And who knows? Who knows who he was, huh?
I don't know. Never saw him. It was in the middle of the night, and I didn't ask him. He saw me stumbling and heading for the edge of the column, and grabbed me and says, "Hang in there." And we, the two of us, stumbled along. You've seen it in the movies, and that's the way it is. We wept all that night, and then the next day. And then they finally let us stop, give us a rest. They loaded us on boxcars at that time.
And this is the famous 40 and 8?
Mm-hmm.
40 people or 8 horses, but I'm sure they stuck a lot more than 40 in there.
60.
Uh-huh.
You couldn't, you sat down with your knees up, and then the guy got behind you and his back to yours were the same. And if you got into that position, everybody got in that position, you could all sit down at one time. Otherwise, you couldn't.
And you probably needed that for some body heat too, right?
Well, the heat came from the manure that was in the boxcar. There was about 8-10 inches of manure in the boxcar, and us city boys didn't know how many BTUs there were on a pound of horse manure.
And this sounds like a miserable existence. I mean, certainly the uncertainty could eat you alive, if not the freezing temperatures and just the agony of. Really not having any sustenance.
We hadn't eaten. When we got captured, we hadn't eaten for 2 days. They just had to bring the chow up to us because when we were by ourselves.
Mm-hmm.
Well, the Jeep didn't get there for 2 days before we were captured. Mm-hmm. So we still didn't have anything to eat until, I guess it would be the second day, they give us a loaf of bread for 5 guys, mm-hmm. one of their brown breads that make out of
sawdust. Tree flour.
Yeah.
He would spend the next 6 months moving from one prisoner of war camp to another, 4 of them in total. He even survived an 8-day, 100-mile forced march through the snow.
Well, you just kept going because you had to keep going. What are you going to do, you know, and make the best of it?
Just the will to survive?
Yep. Yeah, it's there. And you just picked one foot up and put it in front of the other. And you were so damn numb and dumb, and you didn't know. You didn't have time to worry.
At hometownheroesradio.com, you can link to all the full-length original interviews with the Battle of the Bulge survivors you're hearing from today. Because of the heavy casualties suffered, there is a huge need for replacements. And many young Americans experienced their very first taste of combat at the Bulge, including George Hansen of the 11th Armored Division.
We were heading towards the city of Bastogne, and we stopped at night and went to sleep on that ground next to a haystack. And we thought, well, we'll have a good night's rest here by this haystack. And about 10 o'clock, the captain says, we're moving out. So we got in our armored column, tanks in the front, and then half tracks with machine gun squads and other foot soldiers, and we're headed for Bastogne.
And tell us why it was so important to get to Bastogne, because the timing of this was the Battle of the Bulge, right?
That's right, and there were hundreds of soldiers there surrounded by Germans, and our goal was to go and rescue them. So we're on the way up there, and I'm in the back riding along, a couple tanks in front, and then behind us other trucks with more soldiers. And all of a sudden, about 11 o'clock at night, this explosion wakes up the guys like me that were sort of dozing in the back as we went along in this armored column. And it was an explosion. A German shell had come and landed right in the middle of the nine of us in the back. The explosion woke us up if we were asleep. And I immediately felt that my leg on my left side was, I thought it was blown off. So I started feeling to see where it ended. And I got to my foot, and I was very happy that I still had a foot and a leg. But it was numb from the explosion, which ripped off my overcoat that had a hand grenade in it and a camera I carried. And I couldn't feel a thing. But they said, get out of this vehicle fast. So I got out. And, you know, isn't it interesting how God treated me? There was a medic's jeep right behind our vehicle. The nurses, or whoever they were, guys with first aid caps on their head, they took me in this jeep to a field hospital, and then the next day to a hospital where I spent a few weeks in a warm room having meals in bed being treated by American nurses. And I thought, wow, am I ever blessed to be alive and to be here? While the rest of my buddies were for 2 days pinned down by the German artillery, sleeping in the snowbanks.
Yeah, you talk about something that could have saved your life, maybe being shaken up and wounded, and you did get the Purple Heart for that incident. Maybe that did save your life. And more about that shell, so we can understand how amazing it is that you did survive as intact as you were. You said it tore your overcoat off, smashed all the contents, and it also put a hole in the floor of this metal half-track?
That's right. And sitting right next to me, it was very snug back there with all of us together with our heavy overcoats on and a gun in our hand. The guy next to me was killed immediately. They said it kind of blew up his insides. And the one sitting across from him, whose feet, my feet were touching, was also killed immediately. And a couple others were wounded. So when a few weeks later, when I went back to my organization, it was a new bunch of replacements, except for two or three guys of the 12. And the captain says, George, now you are the squad leader. So I took over as the squad leader.
Wow. I know you've lived with that for more than 70 years, but is it a little hard for you to believe that the guy on either side of you, the guy to your right and the guy to your left, they're both killed, that you think you lost your leg, but you didn't, it's intact, and you didn't even bleed?
Well, you know, I said, God, if you get me out alive, I'll do anything. And I began to think, well, he kept me alive through this, and I wonder what's next.
George Hansen would go on to become a pastor and a longtime missionary to Brazil. It's time for our first break, but much more to come as we mark the 75th anniversary of the start of the Battle of the Bulge. When we come back, how a medic escaped from the same SS troops who carried out the Malmedy massacre. Hometown Heroes will be right back after this. Do you ever have those moments where you realize you've been settling for less than the best for far too long? Sometimes we just accept the status quo without looking around for better ways to do things. And I've got to tell you, when it comes to your money, I believe I found a better way with EECU. Take a look at myeecu.org and you'll see why. EECU is not a bank. It's a nonprofit credit union that's all about taking care of you, the member. That's one of the reasons EECU just keeps growing and growing. Close to 300,000 members now in 10 different California counties. Over 30,000 ATMs, free mobile banking. And what I really love is how EECU always goes above and beyond to serve the community. In 2013, the leadership and generosity of EECU helped establish Central Valley Honor Flight. More than 1,000 veterans now have gotten to see their memorials in Washington, D.C. for free. And that's just one example of the community involvement EECU takes oh so seriously. Pick up the phone and become a member today. 1-800-538-3328. That's 800-538-3328.